Carol, can I just ask you, were you briefed about the Australian Nationals issue?
No, not as such. It was alleged by Mr. Key that I had received a document. I called Mr. Tucker in this morning to raise questions about that. He showed me a document which I've never seen before. There are three documents that have been produced by the intelligence service. I haven't seen any one of those three. He said that he had flicked the issue past me and mentioned it in passing, that there wasn't much to it. I don't recall that comment, but I'm not questioning his integrity in saying that. But there was no briefing per se.
So is the Prime Minister wrong to say that you were briefed on this issue? The
Prime Minister's quite wrong. I had not seen the documents. I had not been properly briefed on it. The head of the Security Intelligence Service said he flicked the issue past me and said there wasn't much to it. He didn't dwell on it, was his comment.
Do you recollect hearing about that issue in the briefing, even in passing?
No, I don't recollect it at all, actually, which is surprising, because I was at the forefront of the issue when the Israeli Mossad agents were active in New Zealand. If there had been anything of substance said to me, I'm sure I would recollect it.
So is there a diary note of when this conversation occurred, or when you were meeting with...
I meet with the head of the SIS probably on a 8-weekly basis. There's usually a dozen or so agenda items there. Some we spend some time on, others, as the director would have it, he flicks past me. I don't recall at all seeing the document. I asked to see the document today. I saw it. I have no recollection of ever seeing that. Three documents were produced. Two never came near my office. One the director may have had with him, but I did not see it at the time. No.
And what did you make of what was in the document? What did you make of what was in the documents?
Well, privileged information, but the director's conclusion was there wasn't much to it, and that's why I hadn't been fully briefed.
Can you give us any indication about what those documents are?
Oh, the documents, I didn't see the other two. The one that I flicked at to see whether I'd seen it before, it was fairly inconclusive about investigations into Israeli backpackers at the time of the earthquake.
Mr. Tucker obviously briefed the Prime Minister and told him that you had been briefed on this issue. Was he simply mistaken, in your opinion?
He said he hadn't briefed the Prime Minister personally. His office had briefed the Prime Minister. We agreed that I had not seen the document. He said that he had flicked the issue past me in the midst of other issues, saying that he had not dwelt on it and said that there was probably nothing to it. I don't even recall those comments, but I'm not questioning Mr. Tucker's integrity in saying what he did.
Sorry, what I meant was he obviously said to the Prime Minister that he had briefed you. Was he mistaken in passing on that?
The Prime Minister is incorrect in describing what I had apparently seen or been told as a briefing. There was no such thing.
Did Mr. Tucker let you down by not briefing me properly?
His comment was that he didn't think there was any substance in it, and that's probably what he would have said at the time if it was raised with me.
So when was this briefing?
This meeting was a meeting that took place early in March. So about a week to a fortnight after the earthquake struck Christchurch.
Is that when he flipped it past you? Was
that
when he ceased
with you? Yeah, there was an agenda at that meeting of about 12 items. We spent most of that meeting focused on two. The other items he said he had flicked past me, but indicated that he had not dwelt on them, and it probably suggested there was no substance to that particular item.
And he hadn't left the report behind or anything like that, you know?
No, I when I glanced at the report today, I had definitely not seen that report before.
So from now on, will you be asking him to give you proper briefings on stuff here?
Well, there are two ways of doing this. One is the direct briefing that I get. The second is the briefing of the Intelligence Committee. Very sensitive and confidential matters go before the Intelligence Committee. That item was never raised at the Intelligence Committee. Mr. Key said that was because not everybody had security clearance. But I can assure you that the confidential nature and the sensitive nature of the items that are often brought up at that committee would not make that a good excuse for it not being raised. If the Prime Minister or the SIS had considered it serious enough, it should have been raised.
Earlier in mid-March, obviously, the time that the Darren Hughes allegations first came up, which would have been occupying a lot of your time.
Not really. No, that's really not material to the briefing at all. The briefing contained probably about a dozen items. We focused on two of them. Mr. Tucker cannot say for certain that I saw the document. I most certainly can say for sure that I didn't. And he said, as I said before, he flipped the issue past me, saying that there was probably no substance and didn't dwell on it.
Can you tell us what those other issues in a broad sense were?
No, I can't. The nature of those briefings is such that they are confidential, and I'm under an obligation not to repeat them, as you'd expect.
What do you make of the deal, to use a word, between Labor and the Greens and Ohario Belmont?
There is no deal. There's been no formal discussion. In fact, discussions that I had with the Green leadership, there was no thought at all that either party would stand down in favour of the other party in any electorate. We worked closely together, but we put a choice before the electorate, and they made the decision.
So you're glad they stood down? It's very helpful for Charles Chevelle.
Well, that's a decision for the Greens. It's not a decision that we've asked for or that we've entered into any arrangement over. I've got to say I feel very sorry for Katrina Shanks. I heard her on Morning Report in the morning saying she was out to fight and win the electorate. By the afternoon, the rug had been pulled totally from under her feet. That was embarrassing for her. It showed a lack of respect, I thought, to her desire to give the people in Ohio the choice of a genuine campaign where parties are contesting against each other. And likewise, I find it absolutely incredible that the National Party candidate for Epsom has said that there is no deal. Very clearly there is a deal there, and it's to be the system.
What's the difference between that deal, the bank's deal, and what's happening in Ohio Belmont?
Because there's no discussions being entered into at all between Labor and the Greens for the Greens to stand down. If the Green candidate there is saying that he's going for the party vote, that's his decision. There is no deal. There has been no negotiation. There is no agreement that should happen between Labor and the Greens.
Is it just an understanding?
It's not even an understanding. I said quite explicitly at the meeting with the Greens that we weren't expecting electoral accommodations where we wouldn't run candidates or they wouldn't run candidates. We'll be running in every electorate, and we'll be running to maximise our vote.
It's still rorting the system, though. Gareth Hughes is still rorting. Gareth Hughes and the Greens are still rorting the system, and you're benefiting from it.
No. You see, what the rort is in relation to Epsom is that normally an ACT candidate would not get elected there, and as a result, there would be no ACT members of Parliament. What National is doing is setting up for the ACT party, in their view, to win that electorate and to coattail five other MPs into Parliament. That defeats the purpose of the rule that says that if you don't get 5%, you're not represented in Parliament other than by an electorate system seat. And I believe that system should be changed.
Didn't Labor have accommodations like this with Jimmy Anderson and Wickram or something?
No. We always ran a candidate in Wickram, and as I recall, he ran quite hard, but got thrashed by Jim.
He never gave up on the electorate vote?
No. We've never set out to tell people in an electorate that they shouldn't vote for our candidate. That would be quite wrong.
So there'll be no accommodations, for use of a better word, in places like New Plymouth, for instance, where it was close to
As I said, we had a discussion with the Greens, and we decided that each party would be putting out candidates in every electorate, and that there wouldn't be any effort to try to persuade members of the other party to not vote for their own candidate. I think Labor and Green voters would have a resistance to that sort of direction, and I expect that people in Epsom won't be any too happy about it either.
Yeah, but it's happening in Ohio, though. So
well, Gareth Hughes must have made his own decision there, because it's not as a result of any accommodation or agreement entered into between the Green leaders and myself, I can assure you of that. So to the contrary, we made it clear that our candidates would be running in every seat and would be seeking the electorate as well as the party vote.
So if they try and withdraw in other places, what will you do? Tell them, come on guys, get in and
what any other party does is its own business. I'm only responsible for the Labor Party, and in the Labor Party we'll be running candidates in every electorate, and we'll be running those candidates to maximise their vote on each of the two votes.
Is this going to cost Labor? Are Labor and the Greens splitting the left vote and the right are making use of this?
No, look, I think that there is a rort, and I've described it as a rort, because what what the ACT Party is effectively doing is in collusion with National is to try to get 4 or 5 MPs into Parliament, where strictly they would only be entitled to one if that one person won the electorate seat. I think that undermines one of the basic values of an MP, which is unless you reach the 5% threshold, you're not represented in Parliament. There is a loophole there. It should be closed when there's a review of MMP following the referendum.
The OECD's just recommended to the British government that they should scrap all the exemptions that they have in their VAT, their GST. Could this just be a sign that it's a silly idea to take GST off
for today? I see in reports that 17% of children go to school without breakfast, that 22% of households run out of money and run out of food before the end of the week. We've seen huge rises in the price of basic necessities, food, power and petrol. Families on low and middle incomes are struggling. They need all the help that they can get, and giving them the healthy choice by taking the 15% of GST off fruit and vegetables is sensible from the viewpoint of helping their household incomes and budgets, and sensible from the point of view of encouraging consumption of healthy foods.
But you're following the OECD's advice to put on a capital gains tax, but then it's the other way around. They don't accept that
it's quite possible to have recommendations made and to accept some and to reject others on the basis of your own judgment. We've always done that, we're doing it now, and we'll do it into the future.
Just on the security intelligence issue again, should that have come to the committee? I forget the name of it. The committee.
The Parliamentary Intelligence Committee.
Should John Key have brought that there?
In the normal course of events, if this was a serious issue, and we were led to believe by the Prime Minister in the statements that it was a serious issue under serious contemplation, I would have expected it to come there. We deal with a whole range of issues at that committee. And the discussions are wide-ranging. I'm surprised that it wasn't raised there.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have seemed out of place if he came in and said, we had quite a major investigation into Israelis after the earthquake. It came to nothing, but I thought I'd tell you guys.
I would have expected that would have been raised in the committee, and if I had any knowledge of it from my personal briefings, I would have raised it as well.
So when was the timeline for the committee after that briefing? Was that sort of
The committee met on a number of occasions to look at, it acts as any other select committee, looking at the estimates, looking at the review of the department's expenditure over the last year, and it's been, of course, looking at the amendment to the Security Intelligence Bill. So there was opportunity there for the issue to be raised.
When you say you called it Mr. Tucker this morning, would you categorise that as a please explain meeting?
I texted him immediately. I heard a Q&A on Sunday and said, this is not correct. This is not the information that I've received. He responded to my call this morning, and I arranged for him to come in because it was a discrepancy in what the Prime Minister had said and what the reality was that I recall.
Did he offer to come in and explain?
I said that I needed an explanation of that. I texted him on Sunday.
Is required
9:54 to be precise. So we're dealing with precise intelligence now.
There's a report out today on the death of Lieutenant Timothy O'Donnell. It's called for better medical care of our soldiers in Afghanistan. Have you had a chance to have a look at the evidence?
I've read a couple of reports on it. I haven't read the original report, and it is a concern that the Court of Inquiry has said that there was insufficient in-theatre training. It is a concern that it said the 757 wasn't configured properly for a medevac operation. But that might have put the well-being of the injured soldiers at risk. I think there were 69 recommendations. My expectation is that we would learn from this tragic experience and that the New Zealand Defence Force would implement those recommendations.
And it seems quite late in the play, given how long soldiers have been there and given that they may come home in the next couple of years.
I think it's a reflection that the situation has deteriorated, including in Bamiyan, that an attack of that nature took place. We can't assume that Bamiyan is a safe place for New Zealand soldiers to be. There have been a couple of incidents with IEDs, and there's been an attack on the Kiwi base. I think the recommendations are sensible recommendations from what I've read of them, and I would expect the New Zealand Defence Force to implement them in order to maximise the protection of our people on the ground. Can I just make one other comment, and it's obviously in relation to Norway. Over the weekend. I have sent correspondence to the Prime Minister of Norway, Jens Stoltenberg, and the Foreign Minister and Trade Minister, Jonas Sturre, whom I know very well personally. I've expressed our grief on behalf of the families and the children who died in that incident. Expressed it particularly strongly because of the fraternal links between the New Zealand Labour Party and the Norwegian Labour Party, and also because Norway, like New Zealand, is a small country. To have lost over 90 people in an incident of this nature is just immense for a small nation, and a nation with which we in the Labour Party identify very closely. It's a country that has stood up for peace, it's stood up for human rights, it has a strong reputation, and that makes it even more difficult to comprehend how something of this nature could have happened. I think there's a lesson too that people should not jump to conclusions when there's terrorist attacks. Far from this being an Islamic terrorist organisation that launched the attack, it was absolutely the opposite. A fanatic right-wing zealot who wanted to quote-unquote cleanse Norway of Islamic influences. I think there's a lesson there for not making statements until you've done your homework.
You're talking about Mr.
Key? I'm talking about Mr. Key's view that this proved why we should be in Afghanistan. It proved no such thing. Okay, I'd also like to mention my condolences for the family of our former Chief District Court Judge, Russell Johnson. I was minister at the time he was appointed. He was a very fine and decent man, man with integrity, and his death came as a great shock. Likewise, Fetu Tirukatne Sullivan, who has a very proud reputation as one of our longest standing members of parliament, the first woman Maori cabinet minister, and somebody that worked so hard to look after an electorate that was half the size of New Zealand. So in that sense, it's been a sad weekend. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.